The Tom Woods Show, episode 1321.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, here it is, 2019, and people still think so-called deregulation caused the financial crisis of 2008. This cannot be smashed hard enough. Check out my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman, over at regulationmyths.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Glad to be joined once again by Peter Wallison, whom we've talked to a number of times in the past. He is the Arthur F. Burns Fellow in Financial Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and he's a real expert on financial regulation and deregulation. He was a dissenting member of the 2010 Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, where he took the position that it was the government that was the primary culprit in the housing boom and bust and what followed. He obviously was dissenting from the standard view that this was capitalism run amok. So he did heroic work there. We've talked to him about the Dodd-Frank Act and his criticisms of that. He is a graduate of Harvard Law School. He's widely published. He's a frequent contributor to the op-ed pages of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times. But today we're talking with him about a different topic because he's out with a new book on the administrative state. We're going to talk about what that is. But what we've got are all these federal agencies that, in effect, are making law. And sometimes they are doing things that are clearly contrary to statutory language. And yet they're making law and they're very hard to rein in. And it seems like a violation of the separation of powers and something screwy is going on here. So the book is called Judicial Fortitude, The Last Chance to Rein in the Administrative State. Peter, welcome back.
Happy to be with you, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
I love this little book. I mean, you're packing a real punch in this book. I've read books three times this length that don't have this much meaty information in them. And so you are singing from my hymn book. Books with fluff make me crazy. And this thing, I felt like I learned something on every page. So thank you, first of all, for that. And then secondly—
Thank you.
Well, my pleasure. Secondly, I'd like to start having you explain— in brief, what's meant by the term administrative state?
Well, the administrative state is all of the agencies of the federal government, starting with the top agencies at the top, which would be, you know, the Treasury Department or HHS, and all the way down through these agencies and then through the independent agencies until you get to the independents, like the SEC and the FCC. So there are hundreds and hundreds of these agencies. And they together all operate under the same legal system, the same control by the courts. And this book attempts to show how those agencies can be controlled.
Okay, so this is a shot really at the way the federal government operates on a daily basis in our day and age. And I mean, you're even going all the way back to the progressive era to, you know, to situate the locus of the problem. And so I want to wait until we get, because chapter four, right in the middle of the book, is where you talk specifically about progressivism. So let's start off, though, with maybe a couple of examples of incidents that show people why this could be a problem, because this might seem like an abstract issue. Because the issue here is you have these agencies that are not— they're not Congress. They're a body distinct from Congress. They are not the president. They're executive agencies, but they're making decisions that essentially are legislative in nature, and or they're making decisions that involve highly controversial interpretations of existing law. So give me an example of a case of that happening that should make us alarmed.
Yeah, well, one of the cases I discuss in the book is the Title IX of the education amendments in 1972. It's a long time ago, but the Title IX amendments said, basically, if you are a school and you are accepting federal funds for assistance to your school, then you have to offer the same services, the same educational activities and resources to women as to men. Very simple idea and something we would all agree with. However, using that statute, which applied to schools, the Department of Education began to establish rules concerning sexual harassment, which is really a student-to-student problem, not a problem for the schools. And yet, that series of rules was propounded and then made more complicated and more difficult for schools to operate under, and then covered the entire United States, so that they established under these rules not only what sexual harassment is, but how it can be and should be and must be prosecuted by the schools, and what penalties would result. And all of those things came out of, or spun out of, a statute that applied only to schools and not to how one student related to another. And it's very, very unlikely that in 1972, in that language that I described to you, Congress had any idea that the law that they were creating would be used to cause schools to set up some sort of special arrangement for dealing with student-to-student problems.
Right. And so early on in your book, you have several examples like this that are particularly egregious. Now, I guess before we get into the structural questions like separation of powers and how the framers envisioned the whole process working, I want to ask a more fundamental question, which is, if we have a Congress where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a superstar and she is trying to move the Democratic Party to the left, I think she'll probably have some success with it. She's certainly not going to be voted out by her constituents. They're not going to care, oh, she doesn't play by the rules and she's being naughty to other Democrats. They don't care. They'll keep voting for her. So why would I say to myself, well, I don't trust these administrative agencies. I'm sure Congress will give me a far more sensible interpretation of the laws they're passing. I think they're all crazy.
Well, let's go back to the Title IX issue, and we can explain why this whole thing can be addressed and should be addressed by the courts. First of all, when those regulations came out, they should have been challenged by a school saying, wait a minute, this has nothing to do. We have no reason that we have to set up any kind of sexual harassment rules of the kind you are describing, because that's not what the statute says. And unfortunately, the schools either have not brought that, or where the cases have arisen, the courts have said, as far as we're concerned, you, the agency, are entitled to deference in the kind of interpretations you place on your statutes. Now, that's where the problem arises, because in a case in 1984, the Supreme Court determined and directed lower courts to defer to the interpretations by agencies of their own authority under various statutes. And the result of that is that the agencies have had tremendous latitude to use statutory language for things that Congress never intended. So the problem is not so much in Congress, although we can get to that. There are problems in Congress. But the problem we're dealing with right now in this book is that the statutes that Congress actually does adopt can be reinterpreted over many years by the agencies to give them much more power. And the problem there, of course, is that the agencies then, as you suggested at the outset of this discussion, the agencies then really have the power to make laws for the American people. And if we have a democracy or a democratic republic or a representative republic or anything you want to call it, it can't be based on unelected bureaucracies in Washington making decisions for the American people. It has to begin with Congress. But once Congress creates a law, then the agencies have to be bound by the boundaries of that law and not permitted to go beyond them. And that's what is happening, and that's what happened in Title IX.
So let's say something then about the way the separation of powers is supposed to work. We all know, because we learned it in our school book, that the legislative branch makes the law, the executive branch enforces the law. It's very simple and cut and dried. Whereas these agencies are in a weird limbo state. They're obviously making law, but the argument, I could see two responses to this from people who favor the current setup. One, they, I don't think, would want to be open about, as blunt as they were in the progressive era, which is, look, you stupid rubes need to be ruled over by experts, and doggone it, we intend to do that. They're a little bit more subtle about it today. So secondly, I think they would say, these agencies have to deal with so many minute questions. There's no way that Congress could possibly take upon itself a legislative authority over all these matters. We have to, whether or not it's constitutional, we can talk about separately, but we have to delegate some of these off to these agencies for simple practicality.
That's right. And that has been a problem from the beginning of our republic. Congress, under the separation of powers, under the Constitution, has the sole authority to make the laws. What does that actually mean? What is a law? And how does it differ from a regulation? There isn't, unfortunately, any really applicable set of rules established by the Supreme Court to answer that question. But what we know is that the important decisions have to be made by Congress, the ones that really decide what Americans are required to do. And the agencies are supposed to fill in the blanks. Let's take an example, another example that I talked about in the book, and that is the Clean Water Act. Now, the Clean Water Act, many of the people who listen to your program probably have been affected by that because they've been told that farm ponds and bodies of water that are not constantly flowing but do flow when there has been a severe rainstorm or something like that are covered by the Clean Water Act. And so some people have been fined and other people have had other problems with the government. Who made the decision that farm ponds would have to be covered by the Clean Water Act? It was not Congress that made that decision. It was the administrative agency, which happens in this case to be the Environmental Protection Agency. So there's a problem, and that is Congress must make the important decisions, the serious ones that take property from people, that impose costs on people, that give benefits to people. All of those things are the sorts of things that in a democratic society are made by a representative body under the Constitution. The administrative agency is only supposed to fill in the blanks that are left out. For example, if Congress says that you have to pay a certain amount for overtime to your employees, the agency would define what overtime is and what counts as an employee. Those kinds of questions are details. The main question is you have to pay a certain amount for overtime to your employees. So that's the decision Congress makes. The other ones are the less important decisions that are supposed to be made by the agencies. And the problem is that Congress has not been making any effort to participate in that kind of process. What they have been doing is passing laws that give the agencies very broad powers, they did with the EPA and the Clean Water Act. And then when constituents complain, they say to constituents, well, hey, I never voted for that. That was the administrative agency. But in fact, the Congress has given the agency the power to do things that should have been done by Congress. And what that means is that the separation of powers that is important in our Constitution, that guarantees to the American people the ability to control their own government through this representative process, we elect a Congress to make the laws, that process has been completely circumvented.
And that leads into your chapter on Congress, in which you start off by pointing out that there was a confidence on the part of the framers that the Congress really would be the dominant branch. And for various reasons, we've seen that confidence has been more and more misplaced because of events that have transpired since then. So what has happened to upend, let's say, Congress's dominant role?
That's a very complicated question, I think, and it has, and would have to be. You could write a book about that, you know, just that subject. In Judicial Fortitude, in this book that we're talking about here, I say that the most important reason this has occurred is that Congress finds it easy to make these very broad statutory grants of authority to administrative agencies. Because if they have to make the decisions themselves, they put themselves in jeopardy of not being reelected. And so since they can get away with it, they do it. And the whole purpose of the book, at least at this level, is to make sure that Congress can't get away with things like this. And that means that someone has to step in and say, wait a minute, this statute that you adopted that has been given to Agency 8, that statute is too broad. You did not deal with the fundamental issues here, the ones that are really important. And as a result of that, we're going to declare this law unconstitutional. Now, the Supreme Court has the power to do that. And once it starts to do that, then Congress is going to recognize that it can't get away with what it's been doing over these many years. It's actually going to have to legislate. It's going to have to think about what the important issues are and what issues it has to resolve before it can hand power over to an executive agency. So that's the system, if you will, that I think will work to control Congress, to keep them involved in making the important decisions so that those don't go to the agencies to make.
You would think that if Congress does something and then as the years go on and it wends its way through the administrative agencies and the intent of Congress gets subverted, you would think in principle that an outraged Congress would want to step in and reverse that. And I would be willing to bet that apologists for the present system would say this is how you know that there's general consent to the present system, because at any time, couldn't Congress just intervene and override one of these decisions? And yet they don't.
Right. They don't. They don't because, well, there's so many reasons why they don't. But one of them is, of course, that they are very busy with other things and they can't quite get themselves around to overriding regulations. There are plenty of people in Congress who have been complaining about this, and there have been plenty of people who have introduced laws, and some laws have actually been passed to control the regulatory process. They just haven't been effective. So it's not as though all congressmen are and women are unable or unwilling to deal with this problem. They actually can't deal with it once the problem has developed as broadly as it has. There are 3,000 rules and regulations, more than 3,000 rules and regulations coming out of the regulatory and administrative agencies every year. And in the book, I point out that that is 101,000 rules and regulations since only 1993, in the last 25 years. It's impossible for Congress to deal with these regulations, as it is impossible, as I say in the book, for the president to deal with these regulations. The president could actually stop this from happening, but the president, unfortunately, has other things on his plate. And even though President Trump is attempting to cut back on regulation, even in his first year, 2017, there were still more than 3,000 regulations that came out of his administration. And that's because these things are in a pipeline and they eventually come to the top and they get approved because this is something that the agency has always wanted to do. And the regulations get published and ultimately are binding on the American people. So it is very, very difficult for Congress to deal with a situation like this. Many of these regulations are 100 pages long. Some of them are 1,000 pages long. And so for Congress to look at each of these regulations and try to modify it or repeal it or anything like that would take so much time that they just don't have. So the way to stop it is to give Congress an incentive to actually make the major decisions at the beginning so there are no regulations coming out that go beyond what Congress has actually done. And if they do go beyond what Congress has actually approved, then the courts will turn them back. The courts will have the authority, and they do have the authority now, they just haven't been using it, but the courts would have the authority to declare those regulations unconstitutional because they exceed what Congress has actually adopted.
I want to spend at least a few minutes before we finish on your chapter on economic regulation per se. But first, can you just say a brief word about what the non-delegation doctrine is? It's somewhat self-explanatory, I think. But also the Chevron doctrine, which from a 1984 case that I bet most people are not familiar with.
Right. These are the two elements that I deal with most particularly in the book. There is a chapter on each of them. The non-delegation doctrine is really implementing the separation of powers. The separation of powers in our Constitution says all legislative power is vested in a Congress of the United States. The power to administer, execute, enforce those laws that Congress passes are in the executive branch headed by the president. So once you get a language that says that all legislative power is vested in the Congress, it's obvious that Congress, at least that's what the Constitution said, it's obvious that Congress cannot then say, well, we want the president to legislate, so we're going to delegate to the president the power to legislate. That's exactly what the founding framers did not want, because they grew up in a world in which a king had the authority both to make the laws and to enforce the laws, and they were pretty sure that that was going to lead to tyranny. So the Constitution makes it very clear that the laws can only be made in one place, and that is in a representative Congress, and then the president can enforce what Congress does. Well, that's the non-delegation doctrine. Anyone who reads the Constitution automatically recognizes that since there is supposed to be a clear separation between the legislature and the executive, if the legislature gives the executive the power to make laws, the whole constitutional structure has been violated. And that's where the courts should be stepping in to make sure this doesn't happen. The non-delegation doctrine, unfortunately, has not gone very far. For a while, it was thought to be dead. I think this book re-raises it again, and there are now a number of scholars, not because of this book, but in general, there are a number of scholars who think that it has to be brought back and given more life by the Supreme Court. And if it is, then I think we will have quite a different system in the United States where Congress actually makes the laws and the executive only enforces them, doesn't itself make the laws. Now, not to go too far into this, there is a case that has made it very difficult for anyone to control what the agencies are doing. It's called Chevron versus the Natural Resources Defense Council, which was decided in 1984. And that case is probably the most significant case ever decided by the Supreme Court in this area. And what it says basically is to the lower courts, when the agencies decide something is within their authority, you should defer to that decision. And so that has given the agencies, as I said before, a tremendous amount of latitude. That has to be modified in some way. I think the Supreme Court now with a majority of conservatives, is headed in the directions that I describe in the book. The first is to adopt some kind of non-delegation jurisprudence, some sort of non-delegation doctrine, which they haven't really done in 200 years. And in the second place, to modify this Chevron case so that the courts really make the decision on whether the agency has the power to do what it is claiming it has the power to do.
One final question, Peter, and I'm not going to ask you to try to summarize this chapter because it's that would be ridiculously unfair, but you have a very, very interesting chapter. Was the progressive faith in economic regulation justified? And you say in there that if you get your way procedurally, then it's very likely that at least a substantial portion of the regulations we observe today may go by the wayside, or at least may be interpreted more narrowly. And you then set out to demonstrate that this would not be a bad thing, that in fact we have a superstitious reverence for regulation. Just the word regulation, it seems to have a calming effect on people because it seems to be the opposite of Wild West capitalism. And it's not really that. This is a comic book version of reality. So rather than ask you to justify that belief of yours, maybe you could simply tell us what your ambitions and aims are in that chapter, and then people can go read it.
Well, the big fight here, Tom, is this, and that is the left is very invested in the administrative state and what the administrative state does. This should not be a mystery to anybody, because the left likes the fact that the agencies create these new regulations, that the agencies have a lot of latitude to create the new regulations. The agencies, after all, are people who are living in and around Washington, D.C., and they have much of the attitude toward regulation that the left in general has, just because of where they live and who they associate with. So that is going to be the big fight. When the court starts adopting rules or positions of the kind I'm talking about with respect to the Chevron case and with respect to non-delegation, the first thing that is going to come out of the left is going to be complaints that the American people are then left unprotected against the depredations of the business community, things like that. And that will be a little frightening to Americans. Those are the claims that are going to be made, and certainly they will be picked up by the media and broadcast as a serious problem. That chapter tries to show that where regulations have been removed, things improve. Consumer costs go down, investment in the industries go up, service improves, and that the usual people who oppose these deregulation cases, and I cite several of them, including in air travel and train travel and so forth, the people who oppose these things are not only the regulated industries, which oppose it because they know that this keeps out competition, but also the consumer supporters, the consumer groups. They oppose changes too, because they think that regulation actually improves service and so forth for people, but it has the exact opposite effect. So that's why I cover the whole issue in that chapter.
Let me just read a short passage that really jumped out at me from pages 93 to 94. You say, "By and large, regulations do not go away after a while. The government does not take the trouble to repeal the ones that are no longer of use. They simply continue in effect and are sometimes resurrected to do service when an agency encounters a new problem. The Labor Department is still issuing regulations under the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Technically, then, a business may be subject to thousands of regulations that are now out of date and no longer enforced, but must still be on the agenda of diligent compliance officers because no one can be sure that the issuing agency will not enforce them someday." Now, that's one small passage from your book, but that as an indication to me, first of all, of the scope of the problem, and secondly, again, of how much meat there is in this book. First of all, I hadn't even known that. And secondly, yeah, that would put anybody in the private sector constantly in a state of agitation because you don't know what kind of Soviet commissar could knock on your door and technically have something to point to justify himself.
That's right. That's right. And that's, of course, what does that do? At the very least, it adds tremendous costs to products and services because you have to have all these compliance people around to tell you what you could do without running afoul of a government regulation. Yeah. And since there are 101,000 regulations since only 1993, you can imagine what a difficult problem this is for businesses.
You have a great chart on page 94 tracking, let me look at the exact, cumulative final rules published in the Federal Register, 1993 to 2017. And it just goes up every year. And it goes up perfectly. I mean, that graph is almost a work of art if it weren't depicting something so awful. It goes up perfectly. It doesn't matter what party is in power. Doesn't matter if there's a financial crisis.
Right.
It just goes up and up and up and up. And all the time on social media, you run into people who say, well, you know, our unregulated capitalism has caused another problem. And I want to take charts like this and just put them right in their faces and say, then what do you say about this? So the book is Judicial Fortitude, The Last Chance to Rein in the Administrative State. I'm going to link to it on our show notes page. This is episode 1321. So it'll be tomwoods.com/1321. Peter, best of luck with this, and thank you for your yeoman service.
Thank you very much, Tom. Wonderful to talk with you.
All right, folks, let's see. I was a day late this week. It's a long story, just a long story, but I'm still going to get the 5 episodes out. Just one of them will probably trickle out over the weekend. So you're getting your 5 episodes. Don't you worry about that. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about American economic history with the great Jeff Herbiner. Then the day after that, we're going to talk about Sam Konkin and counter-economics and agorism. And that's going to be a lot of fun. And then over the weekend, there'll be yet another episode, just a regular episode, just a day late. And I think you're going to enjoy all these. So make sure you subscribe to the show, which you can easily do over on iTunes. And then one other thing, remember, don't say anything. Let's see if we can somehow keep this a secret. But remember, I'm donating $10 for everybody who signs up for Steve Clayton's webinar and stays to the end. I'm donating $10 to Scott Horton for every single person who does that. Because Scott is on a shoestring budget. He puts out an amazing podcast. He spends a lot of time studying and learning so he can be as amazing as he is. And I want to give him a big gift. And we're all going to do it together. So sign up over at tomwoods.com/Steve. Make sure and be there for that event. Stay through to the end. I'll count how many people are on there. And then we're going to take that amount, multiply it by 10, and send that in dollars over to Scott Horton. So there you go. I was thinking, who's a good libertarian who's deserving? And Scott's name just went right to the top of my list. So make sure and sign up, tomwoods.com/Steve. Let's talk American economic history tomorrow. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.